This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. He was one of the most outspoken and popular drivers of all time. He was also one of the best. You always got your money's worth if you paid to watch Bobby Unser from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to Pikes Peak, where he and his family won so many times it was unofficially renamed Unser Mountain. Bobby Unser was born in Colorado, but has always been most closely associated with his longtime home of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
There just was no way to make it in Colorado Springs, so my dad and mother came to Albuquerque. Daddy and Mom came here, and they didn't have anything when they came here. And Daddy worked at a wrecking yard, a junkyard, and then bought some land out west of Albuquerque, and he started on the garage business, which was Highway 66. And so Daddy set up a garage on Highway 66 of his own, and he built everything himself. He was very smart. He could do electrical. He was self-taught. He only had an eighth grade education. He did his own electrical, his own plumbing, his own design of the shop, the house. He built everything himself, with, of course, Mom and us kids helping, you know, if you can count that much help in those days.
He started racing modifieds in the late 40s at the ripe old age of 15.
Ultimately, when I was 15 years old, they had a racetrack in Albuquerque, a dirt track, and Daddy had cars because they were super modifieds, which they originated in Albuquerque. Not that Albuquerque was modern. It's just that how you could take wrecking yard, junkyard parts and make them into fairly fast race cars. That was the first of the super modifieds. And so when I was 15 years of age, I drove my first race. And so that's how I started. Now, when I became 16 years of age, I won the entire Southwestern Championship, which encompassed Southern Colorado, New Mexico, a great part of Arizona, West Texas. And so I was a child superstar.
But it was actually the Pikes Peak Hill Climb where Unser first became known. The 1955 Hill Climb was counted in the AAA standings, Unser following in the family tradition of racing on the tricky 156-turn track. He finished fifth and then won six of the next seven when the race fell off the official IndyCar schedule.
I never dreamed in those days of ever going to Indianapolis. As an example, none of us did. And I only dreamed about winning Pikes Peak. Now, I accomplished that. I won it more than any human being, dead or alive, set more records than anybody, and whatever it was for a record at Pikes Peak, I did 13 times. And so the thing about it was, is Pikes Peak was my target. And that was because of Uncle Louie. Uncle Louie eventually won Pikes Peak 9 times. And I loved my Uncle Louie. He was a big mentor. And everything was fine between us. It's just that he was the king. And they used to write in the newspapers up there that he was the king of the mountain. Well, I just told him, I said, someday there's going to be a new king, and it's going to be me. And I meant that, but I didn't mean it in a bad derogatory way. I meant it in a complimentary way. And when I got it up to 9 wins and I tied him, I saw Uncle Louie. Of course, he lived right at the foot of Pikes Peak, and I told him, I says, next year, Uncle Louie, going to be my number 10. I'm going to have accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. And I did some more just to show him it wasn't a mistake.
Unser's older brother Jerry was also a driver, and the elder Unser had his sights set on a different venue, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Jerry qualified for the 1958 500, but never got to turn a full lap in the race, as the rookie driver got caught up in the now famous first lap crash that took the life of Pat O'Connor and wiped out 7 cars from the field.
Car number 5, the Zinc Special, is the first to wreck, another over the wall, and we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cars piled up here on the northeast turn. The 54 Novi into the infield, car number 19 in the infield, 68 now down into the infield, and it's almost impossible to identify the others. Out of car number 5 now, it's Ed Elysian, and car number number 91 against the wall. That is all that we can see at the moment. Further down the track, there are still others. One car has left this track, Sid, and did go over the retaining wall.
That one car that left the track was Jerry Unser, who went over the wall. Unser survived unhurt. But the next year, Jerry Unser was involved in a serious practice crash and died 2 weeks later of his injuries.
The day before Jerry died, he's talking about. He didn't know how bad he was burned. And to tell you the truth, we didn't either. I mean, what do you really know about doctor work, you know? He's laying in the bed and we're talking, and he's talking about me coming back to Indianapolis, that he thinks he's got a car that I could take my driver's test in. That's how Jerry passed away, was thinking about things like that. He wasn't laying, well, we didn't know he was on his deathbed, but he wasn't laying there feeling sorry for himself. He was just laying there thinking Bobby needs to get going and get back there because Jerry thought that he had a car that I could get my test in.
Bobby Unser kept racing and impressing, mainly in sprint cars, but hadn't become a household name on the IndyCar trail just yet. He finally got his first shot at the Indianapolis 500 in 1963 when established star Parnelli Jones convinced him to come to the Brickyard.
For some reason or another, we just hit it off really good and became instant friends. And I started teaching Parnelli how to do Pikes Peak, how to run it, how to learn the road, how to do his chassis, you know, the little tricks that I knew about Pikes Peak. Well, Parnelli had already seen me running sprint cars and midgets out in California. He was obviously ahead of me, and he thought I had some talent. And so up at Pikes Peak, he told me, he says, you ought to come and go to Indianapolis. I said, no, I said, I'm not that good yet. And I says, I don't know. I don't see that. I want to go run sprint cars, and I want to run midgets, and I want to run in the Midwest. I want to run Kansas and Oklahoma and California. I want to run every place. And so that was fine. And I was starting to win a fair amount of races. So Parnelli just called on the phone one day, and he says, I've got you a car to take your driver's test at in Indianapolis in the coming May. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, was I happy? I guess you'd have to say I was, but I was probably more scared than I was happy because I didn't think I was capable of doing Indianapolis. I really didn't see it.
Unser started out the month driving the American Rubber and Plastic Special.
It was not a good race car. It was a lay-down offie roadster. I guess you could say I didn't have really a good team at all. Plus, the car wasn't really good. The guy didn't spend any money on it. What could I say? He was a cheap, lower-class car owner.
Parnelli would intervene again when legendary car owner Andy Granatelli was looking for a driver who could get his temperamental Novi up to speed. Jones suggested that Granatelli should give Unser a shot. Granatelli reportedly responded, "Who's Bobby Unser?" It's perhaps the last time that question was ever asked at IMS.
A lot of drivers that tried the car, nobody went even a little bit fast in that car. Hurtubise was driving the lead car for Granatelli, and he was going very fast. Make a long story short, and Granatelli finally asked me if I wanted to take the car out, would I try not to wreck it? So at any rate, he said, all right, go get your uniform on. Well, I ran all the way back to the shop, got my uniform on, came out, got into that race car, and my third or fourth lap around the track was fast enough to qualify. It was just magic. And so I came in, and the wind was beating me in the face, and the car didn't fit me. And I asked him, I says, any chance we could maybe put the windshield a little bit higher, put a little piece of plexiglass on it. And of course, I mean, he must have had 30 guys there working. He did that stuff. I went out again and went just faster again. So now I'm one of the faster cars in the field. Only my second time out in the car. Long story short, I made the race in the car.
Unser jumped in the Hotel Tropicana Novi, one of the loudest and most popular cars in Speedway history, to try and qualify for his first 500-mile race.
There he is on the turn, onto the straightaway. Let's wait and watch.
The rookie put the Novi in the show, qualifying 16th. But he didn't last long on race day.
Right down in front of us, unfortunately, but out of his car and standing along the side is Bobby Unser in car number 6, the Hotel Tropicana Novi. Gas and water coming down on the track. They will have to slow down completely. Bobby gets out of the car and runs over across the track. Coming out of that turn, he spun once, hit the wall, came to rest with the nose of number 6, the bright yellow Novi, here against the wall. Bobby is okay. The car is damaged on the right rear.
Unser crashed on lap 2, finishing last.
Bobby Unser is the driver, a fine driver here at the Speedway. And Bob, I wonder if you could tell us exactly what happened to you.
Yes, I can. I was coming down the front straightaway, and everything was just fine. We weren't going too fast, just hitting a pace. All of a sudden, Dick Grafman, for some reason or another, and slowed down real slow right in the middle of number 1 turn. It was either hit him or spin the car, and I had to spin the car to miss him.
Did you intentionally spin it then, turn left and lock up?
Well, I didn't intentionally spin it all the way, but I did intentionally get the car sideways. Once it does that, there's not much you can do about it.
The next year, he was back behind the wheel of another Novi for Granatelli. The 1964 didn't go any better for the sophomore driver.
There has been a spectacular crash almost at the head of the main stretch. There's so much fire and so much smoke, I am unable to see any car at all. Now the smoke is clearing away. We'll try to get the glasses on it, and perhaps somebody from the tower can see, Sid. Somebody did not make that number 4 all the way around, and kerwoom, right into the fence.
Unser was caught up in the disastrous crash that took the life of Eddie Sachs and Dave McDonald, and also involved future 500 winner Johnny Rutherford. Unser finished 32nd. He had one more 500 start in the Novi, finishing 19th in 1965. Unser says while the Novis were fast, he knew they would not finish.
Those were good days in my life. There wasn't any chance of my finishing the race, and I knew that. I hoped that it would finish, but the car would always go fast. And to Bobby Unser, that became the most important thing. You know, I used to have a theory that if you practiced fast, you qualified fast, and you led the races, or went really fast in the races, then everybody knew you, and life got a lot easier. Sponsorship, money, rides, you know, cars to drive was always a lot easier. Now, if you didn't do any of those three, you became what's known as a failure.
After a falling out with Granatelli for 1966, Unser had a new team. He joined Bob Wilkie's Leader Card outfit, the same organization that had won the Indianapolis 500 twice with Roger Ward behind the wheel. He still was looking for his first IndyCar win, but big things were on the horizon.
There's a checkered flag for Bobby Unser, winner of the 1968 500-mile race.
This is the history of the 500. This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. Bobby Unser's Indy 500 career got off to about as slow a start as you can, with a 33rd and a 32nd place finish in his first two races. But he was always known as a charger, and put the early struggles behind him, according to Speedway historian Donald Davidson.
Bobby would qualify fast each year. He was the 12th fastest qualifier in 63, and the 5th fastest qualifier in 64, although he wasn't up at the front, but... You could go both ways with this. The whole year evolved around the Indianapolis 500. But when the race was over, you had to wait another year for the next Indianapolis 500, but you didn't have to wait another year for the next race because you were running all the time. And Bobby Unser would run, he ran the whole championship season, and he would run sprint cars, occasional midgets, and then a little bit later on, he ran stock cars. So there was still a lot of racing to be done. And you would just have to sort of move on to the next one.
For 1966, Unser had a new team. And he knew he had something special coming.
I knew I had a good team. Because remember, I went into Leader Card Racers. And if you go back over history, Leader Card in those days was the same as Roger Penske is today. That was the Roger Penske of racing. Bob Wilkie had the good race cars, the good mechanics. And so I hung around. Don Branson was driving for Judd Phillips, Leader Card. Well, Don and I were exceptionally close friends. He was almost like a father to me. And we ran all the sprint car circuits against each other, and yet still stayed good friends. And so the long and the short of that was that he was going to retire. I was going to step into Bob Wilkie's deal. We had two teams, one A.J. Watson, one Judd Phillips. I was going to get Judd Phillips' ride, Don Branson's ride, which is what I wanted. That was going to put me on top. And it did.
Success did not come immediately for Unser in his new outfit, although he finished 8th at the 500 in May and got his first championship car victory on the 4th of July. It came at Pikes Peak, which once again counted in the IndyCar standings. Two more wins followed in 1967, and a third-place finish in the overall standings was Unser's best to date. Unser finished 9th at the 500 in May, his second straight top-10 finish in the greatest spectacle in racing. All of Unser's hard work began to pay big dividends in 1968. His Rizlone-sponsored Eagle was clearly the class of the early part of the USAC season. Unser won three of the first four races leading up to the month of May 1968, which caught the eye of his former car owner, Andy Granatelli. By 1968, Granatelli had scrapped the loud Novis for the nearly silent turbine-powered cars and nearly won with one in 1967 with Parnelli Jones behind the wheel. For 68, the flamboyant car owner had planned a three-car assault of turbine-powered Lotuses with Formula One stars Jim Clark, Jackie Stewart, and Graham Hill behind the wheels. But Clark was killed in a Formula Two race in April, and Stewart was injured and unable to participate, leaving Granatelli looking for drivers. He turned his attention and his checkbook to Unser.
When Granatelli had his problems, they tried to hire me out from under Goodyear or out from under Leader Card Racers. Probably one of the happiest days of my life. And it all happened right out under the scoring tower, right out there on the pit apron at the Speedway. And when it got up, you got to remember the year now, when it got up to $1 million, I still said no. And Andy and Vince are screaming at me so loud. So I've got Larry Truesdale in the Goodyear engineers, Ed Alexander, and those guys standing outside the door. And I got the Firestone guys on the opposite side of this little driveway going through. And they're all standing out there, and we're standing under the scoring tower in Granatelli's. Both of them are screaming at me, and they just couldn't understand how I just kept telling them no. I says, I have a deal with Goodyear, and I says, I have a deal with Leader Card Racers, Bob Wilkie. I says, I'm not going to change, and I says, there's nothing you guys can do to make me want to change. And I just kept saying no, and they kept raising the price up, or the fee, and just kept going and going and going, and pretty soon they're screaming. It's so loud, everybody's trying to hear what we're saying out there. Well, bottom line was, I said no and walked away, and I walked by Truesdale with Goodyear, and I says, you're still my boss, Larry, don't worry about that.
Bobby Unser at the time was sort of very much the knight in shining armor. He was sort of like a superstar of the future. A lot of great interest in the Unser brothers, which was a good story, plus the mother. Great, you know, there was a lot of human interest there. Plus the fact that Bobby was sort of like a very, you know, dashing young hero. And the fact that there was one of him and there were three turbines, it seemed like that they were ganging up on him.
Two of the turbine cars grabbed the first two spots on the grid. Unser started on the outside of the front row with the fastest piston-driven car in the race. But it was actually Unser who led much of the race, including 118 of the first 165 laps.
Car number three, Bobby Unser, the Rizlone Special, holding that lead. A turbocharged Offenhauser, Eagle chassis, and Bobby has made a tremendous run for today.
But while Unser led most of the laps late in the race, he found himself in second place behind Joe Leonard in one of Andy Granatelli's STP turbines. And in between Leonard and Unser was another STP turbine driven by Art Pollard, who was acting as a bit of a jam car, according to Speedway historian Donald Davidson.
There was a yellow, but we still weren't using the pace car yet, and for several more years. So it was up to the participants to regulate themselves. Well, guess what? And I remember that Joe Leonard would come by, and then there would be other lapped cars, and then Art Pollard with a third turbine going considerably slower with Bobby Unser right behind him. And there's no question in my mind that he was instructed to hold Bobby Unser back because Leonard would be able to increase his lead. Well, it was done for several laps, and because Pollard was running so much slower, it was obvious. It wasn't subtle in the slightest, and the crowd were booing. And I don't think that helped the turbine cause any. The crowd was booing roundly. And I don't remember if there was somebody went, or two or three people may have gone over to where Harlan Fengler, the chief steward, would stand on the grass verge. Very vulnerable to all of the other participants. And then I think he then went out and either shook his finger or two or three other officials went up and they were quite emphatic in their visual request of Pollard that he speed up a little bit, which he did. And so by the time the green flag came out, whatever disadvantage Bobby Unser had, now the advantage was back.
But when the green flag came out, a dramatic call on the Speedway Radio Network changed the course of racing history.
Sid Collins once again here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway as the frustration continues for Granatelli. Number 60 is dropped out of the number one turn. Come in, Mike Ahern.
Yes, Sid, we've got the glasses on him. He is just entering the number one turn right toward the end of the main straightaway, and they've got a crew of about a dozen people surrounding the car, number 60. Joe Leonard is still in the cockpit. What happened, we don't know. As soon as the green flag was waved, he slowed down, suddenly came along the track apron, and just stopped, short of the infield grass. He's still in there. I don't know if they're going to try to push that car out or not. We've got the glasses fixed on him. Now they are pushing it. Now they're pushing it back into the infield grass. I think Joe Leonard's out of this race, Sid.
Leonard dropped out with a fuel shaft failure less than 10 laps from the finish. Just moments later, Pollard dropped out with the same problem.
And 1968 is truly the year for Bobby Unser. There he goes. The fans straight at the fence, clapping and applauding him on. The four and Jim Shelton.
All right, Ron, here is a confident guy. He should be. He's almost home right now. Orange, black, and white car from Albuquerque, New Mexico. A handsome lad and a great driver, Bobby Unser. And here is Sid Collins.
The white flag now for Dan Gurney, who's going to come in second. There's a checkered flag for Bobby Unser, winner of the 1968 500-mile race.
Bob, welcome to Victory Lane.
Well, thank you very much. I can't hardly hear, so I don't know if I'm talking too loud or not, but can't believe I'm here. Things looked real good, and then they looked pretty bad there today for a while.
I understand when you pulled out of the pit in your last stop, you seemed to be accelerating slower than in the previous two. Did you have any kind of problem?
Yes, my gear shift became disconnected, and I only had one gear. I had my high gear. And actually, with a turbo charged off, you can't hardly get the car moving that way. So I had to take off very slowly, and of course, it cost me an awful lot of precious time that I had worked real hard to get.
One of Unser's proudest memories came when he overheard Speedway owner Tony Holman calling the 1968 500 the greatest he had seen.
Tony Holman said that, and he said it right on the speakers around the racetrack and to the press, and it was a good race. You know, we carried 70 or 75 gallons of fuel then, and pit stops you didn't make every 10, 20, 30 laps. You went a long time, so you really had a lot of good, hard racing, and I think it was better, but I would never go back to carrying that much fuel. It's just that if you do it, you don't know any better. That's just the way you did it, you know.
At the age of 34, Bobby Unser was an Indianapolis 500 winner, and that opened up plenty of doors for the astute businessman.
It changed my life immediately because I went from being a really poor man to a fairly well-to-do man, and I wasn't like a lot of the race drivers. I took racing and got into the endorsement business. I was one of the early race drivers that got heavy into the endorsement business. So people don't realize it, but I made more money doing that than I did winning races or driving race cars or worrying about contracts.
Unser won five races and took home his first USAC National Championship that year by the slim margin of just 11 points over Mario Andretti. In 1969, Unser became very familiar with the number three. He started third in the 500 and finished third. And in the national championship, he ended up third. 1970 was Bobby Unser's final season at Leader Cards. He finished 11th in the 500, which Brother Al won, and he was runner-up to his younger brother in the national championship standings. The two brothers have always been close, but on race weekends, things tended to get a little interesting.
You got to remember, we represented the biggest companies in the business of motor racing in those days. That was Firestone and Goodyear, plus sponsorships. Look at Parnelli Jones. Look at Dan Gurney. Look at the big money. I was on one side of the street, and Al was on the other side. During the week, we were totally brothers in family, and good brothers in good family. Did snowmobiling together, rode dirt bikes together, did everything together. And just a good, good, healthy, close family. But we didn't drill each other like Al had his secrets, I had mine. And we didn't let that interfere. In other words, during the week, don't talk about the, maybe talk about the racing, but don't get into what did you do to your car? What did you do to yours? We didn't do that. We kept at arm's length that way, so to speak. And when we raced, we had to always know that we were brothers. We had to know through quite a few years there that we were both up on top of the heap. In other words, extremely well known. And so anything that bad that might happen between us would get too much ink, would be bad press. And so we were always a little bit careful on the racetrack.
For 1971, Unser had a new team, the All-American boy going to All-American Racers to drive for the legendary Dan Gurney. And the volatile combination would provide plenty of speed.
Bobby Unser from Albuquerque, New Mexico, may have weathered the storm, so to speak, and pushed himself into victory lane here.
This is the history of the 500. This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. 1971 saw Bobby Unser in a new ride with a former rival Dan Gurney calling the shots as team owner. All-American Racers, with Unser behind the wheel, would become synonymous with speed. In the 11 races which Unser started in 1971 for Gurney, he sat on the pole for 7 of them. He won 2 events and led 21 laps at the 500 before being involved in a late accident.
Hold on. Here's the yellow is out. The yellow is out. Jim, can you see it?
Yeah,
Jim Shelton.
Two cars. I was facing the other direction, and they're clear down, almost out of my sight. Tremendous crash into the outside retaining wall, and they went in to Mark Donahue's car down there.
For 1972, speeds were skyrocketing, and Dan Gurney's Eagle was the car to beat. Of the 9 races Unser drove on the USAC Championship Circuit, he won the pole for 7 of them. Just how badly did the team want to take the top spot on the time charts? Listen to what Speedway historian Donald Davidson has to say about one of the poles the team didn't win.
In 1972 at Milwaukee, he'd broken the track record and sat on the pole for every race. And they went to the Milwaukee 200 in August, and a lot of the races they dropped out of. So they went to the Milwaukee 200 in August, and Bobby ended up not winning the pole. I think Mario won the pole and Bobby was outside front row, but there had been like an electrical surge at some point. And the thinking was that the clocks had given a bad reading. And so the next thing you know, here comes Bobby in cities. Oh, had they blown up? No. They just decided to withdraw. And I thought, why would they do that? And it was that it was in a form of protest that the clock had given them a bad time. And I thought, well, you're starting on the outside of the front row. Why wouldn't you go ahead and it wasn't the idea to come and win the race? Well, apparently on that day, no, it wasn't. They had decided that their goal would now be to win the pole for every event, and when they didn't, they withdrew.
The huge bolt-on rear wings were really sending speed soaring at the Brickyard in 1972. When qualifications opened that day, the one-lap track record stood at just over 179 miles an hour. It was broken several times on May 14, 1972, and stood at 189.474 when Bobby Unser went out for his shot at the pole. He didn't just beat the record, he shattered it with a lap of 196.678 miles an hour. The track record jumped 17 miles an hour in one day, And Unser says there's a number of factors that went into that increase.
Well, it wasn't just the rear wings. It was a different concept of how to build race cars. And what happened is Roman Slobodinsky, that's a hard name to pronounce, but Roman was a good engineer. And Gurney, of course, extremely smart guy. Not a good businessman, okay? But really good with race cars. I mean, you just can't imagine. He was a Roger Penske of that era. But he was also an engineer. He's also a mechanic and a hell of a good race driver. So when I took that job over, I really was at the forefront of the entire world. And that car in 1972 caused the entire world in motor racing to change. Even to the stock cars, they started changing their concepts of where the weight should be, where this and that and the other should be, the height of the cars, the center of gravity, and all of that type of stuff just changed. And it changed overnight.
But the pole sitter wasn't around to enjoy his lightning-fast Eagle for long.
Now to turn three, and here's Ron Carroll.
And said, Bobby Unser just dropped down into the grass here in three. I think he's over in four right now.
Jim, pick him up if you can see him, please.
He certainly is, and we're sorry to see that. Well, we don't know where he's out of the race at all, but he came by here mighty slow, Sid, and he looks like he's just kind of drifting into the pits. He's not going in very fast at all, and perhaps you can see him down there now.
Yes, we can. We can see him, I guess the word would be limping. Chuck Marlowe can see him better. Chuck?
Right, Sid, he just came by me and threw something out of the cockpit. Could have been one of the visors. He's just coasting in, power off. Car number six down in front of you now.
Unser dropped out with an ignition rotor issue on lap 31 and finished 30th. He finished 8th in the national championship standings that season and a disappointing 12th the next season, which included a 13th place finish at the 500, a race he actually led for 39 laps. Unser bounced back in a big way in 1974. In the 13 races on the schedule, he finished in the top two in 9 of them, with 4 wins. He started 7th and finished 2nd to Johnny Rutherford at the 500, and that helped propel him to his second USAC national championship. But success at the 500 was what Unser was looking for, and he'd find it in 1975 by being in the right place at the right time. He qualified on the outside of the front row, in the same spot where he won in 1968, but didn't lead much of the race in the Jorgensen Eagle. Molly Dullenbach dominated, but he burned a piston after leading 96 laps. Late in the race, with the skies getting increasingly dark, the yellow flag came out for a lost wheel on Gary Bettenhausen's car. Unser was leading and chose to pit. So did second-place driver Johnny Rutherford.
Okay, well, here's what we set up right now. At 171 laps out of 200, we have on the pylon scoring tower the number 48. That number is Bobby Unser, the Jorgensen Steel Eagle. Car built and entered by Dan Gurney, man who finished here second several times himself. And that car is considered to be first. Number two, Johnny Rutherford, defending champion from last year, the Gatorade McLaren, is running second.
Unser maintained his lead, and moments later, the sky finally opened up.
So if the rain comes out and we're starting to see some heavy wind, this race could well be stopped. In fact, there comes the rain pretty heavily. We're watching Pat Vidan. The yellow is out. And we're going to wait to make it official if he's going to pull out the red or not, which has to happen. Now it's pouring down rain. That's going to be it. And Bobby Unser from Albuquerque, New Mexico, may have weathered the storm, so to speak, and pushed himself into victory lane here by virtue of water. It appears that has happened.
We've got a Bobby Unser in victory lane. And welcome home, brother. It's been a while.
Well, thank you. It's certainly been a nice day. And I just don't know what to say except I'm sure happy little boy.
Well, hey, the way you guys had it worked, it seemed to me it was a race in the last few minutes of pitting and then pitting again. And who got topped up last? Were you banking either of you on the weather, Dan?
Well, we were certainly curious. We didn't know quite what to do, but when Johnny came in that last time, we knew that it was okay, and we're surely thirsty for a drink of milk.
There was a long yellow after the Sneba accident, and then actually several things happened there in 75 where the outcome could have been several different ways, and we'll just go to the point where rain comes at 174 laps when you have Bobby Unser leading. Rutherford is catching Bobby, and Foyt was catching both of them. So you think, well, what a shame that you couldn't have played out to 200 laps, because you would have had a heck of a finish between the three of them. But take it another way, there was quite a bit of downtime because of the Tom Sneba accident, and Wally Dallenbach was actually the dominant driver, and Dahlenbeck had dropped out just a few laps before the rains came. If the rains had come a few laps earlier, then Wally Dahlenbeck would have been an Indianapolis 500 winner.
Unser was now a two-time winner, but the storm clouds that ended the 500 followed him the rest of the season. Despite winning the greatest spectacle in racing, All-American racers did not finish out the USAC Championship season, and Unser broke a leg at Michigan, driving for his former chief mechanic, Judd Phillips' Sugar Ripe Prune team. Unser moved to Bob Fletcher's team for the next two seasons, the second of which was one of the worst in his career. A brief reunion with a reconstituted All-American Racers fielded a pretty car in 1978, but the results were not nearly as good-looking as the ride. But Unser wasn't close to being done. In fact, his career wasn't winding down. He actually caught a big break when he was hired by Roger Penske after the captain fired national champion Tom Sneva. Unser immediately clicked with Penske's team. He sat on the pole in the 1979 opener and rolled off fourth at the 500. Bobby's brother Al dominated the early stages before dropping out with transmission trouble. That handed the top spot over to Big Brother.
Bobby Unser leading at the moment. Rick Mears right behind him. Bobby Unser looks like he's going to head in for a pit stop. Bobby Unser indeed heading. No, something's wrong in Bobby Unser's car. Something appears to be wrong with Bobby Unser's machine. He slowed coming off the fourth turn, pulled to the inside of the race course. Rick Mears is now your leader, and Bobby Unser is running slow into the first turn.
All in all, the brothers Unser led 174 laps that day, with Bobby leading a race-high 89 of them. But with less than 20 laps to go and victory in sight, Unser started having gearbox trouble. He lost the lead and the race to teammate Rick Mears, but held on for fifth place. He won six times on the car trail and finished second to Mears in the final standings. Another second place in the standings was in the cards in 1980, as nobody had anything for Johnny Rutherford and the Yellow Submarine at the Brickyard. On the kart circuit, Unser was the only driver to keep JR honest. Together, they won 9 of the 11 events. But Bobby Unser had one more big day in racing to come, even if he would have to wait all summer for it to be official.
Bobby out again, and Bobby going out very fast a car. What's he doing?
This is the history of the 500. This is the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson. When the cars arrived for the 1981 Indianapolis 500, all of the teams in Gasoline Alley had their eye on how to torpedo the Yellow Submarine. Jim Hall's ground effects creation dominated, with Al Unser behind the wheel before dropping out in 1979, then cleaned house with Johnny Rutherford at the controls the following year. Roger Penske's team responded in 1981 with the PC9B, and the team promptly put it on the pole with 47-year-old Bobby Unser behind the wheel. Unser led early and often, challenged mainly by Patrick Racing teammates Gordon Johncock and Mario Andretti, who was bidding to be the first driver to win from the last row. On lap 146, Tony Bettenhausen had a tire deflate, sending him into Gordon Smiley and sending Smiley into the wall. That brought the leader, Mario Andretti, in for a pit stop, followed closely by second-place Unser. Unser got out of the pits first, with Andretti closely behind. While the two cars were exiting the pits, the pace car was on the track leading the rest of the field around the oval. Unser stayed on the apron and rolled past more than a dozen cars before getting into line behind the pace car. Andretti passed a couple of cars as well, then blended into line with the others. In the moment, it seems like no big deal. In fact, the Speedway Radio Network makes no mention of it at all. But at the time, ABC Television was showing the race on a tape-delayed basis. While putting the event together in post-production for that night's broadcast, this is how it was presented.
Bobby out again, and Bobby going out very fast a car. What's he doing? Look at that. He's passed about half a dozen cars.
Oh, James, that's...
Under the yellow, you can't do that.
That is a no-no. He has accelerated probably in the haste of leaving the pit lane. He's certainly overtaken these other cars. I'm not sure why he did that. I know that you're certainly not supposed to do it. The regulations say that under yellow flag conditions, you must not pass any other cars, and that certainly has been the case here. He certainly passed other cars. Right now, of course, they're under the yellow. There you see him in the blue and red car there, blue and yellow car.
Back on track, Unser battled with Andretti and Johncock, passing the latter for the lead for the last time on lap 182. Unser goes on to join the three-time winners club by 5 seconds.
1968, 1975, and apparently 81 to call the winner of the the 500-mile race. Here is Paul Page.
Bobby Unser, the Norton Spirit car number 3, accepts the twin checkered flags from Dwayne Sweeney. Bobby Unser has won the Indianapolis 500.
Bobby Unser, welcome back home to Victory Lane.
Well, thank you. I can't tell you how nice it is to be here. Been a long race, Bill.
Well, you had yourself a car, and you had a May, I think, that you believed was going your way from the very beginning. You seemed to say each day this was your May.
Well, that's what happens when you have a good crew and owner like Roger Penske and a sponsor like Norton and a crew like we have. You know, that's race cars are good. Designer Pencil's done a hell of a job. We just really... Things been so good this month, we're just about half scared to realize that they're here.
But Unser's victory celebration was short-lived because the next morning, the United States Auto Club declared that second-place finisher Andretti was the winner because Unser had passed cars under the yellow flag. Unser was dropped to second place, a decision Penske Racing immediately protested. The bizarre victory banquet now had a guest of honor who hadn't actually been to Victory Lane. The story gets even stranger as an appeals panel convenes in June, but did not render a decision until October. In the end, a 3-member USAC appeals board votes 2-1 to reinstate the victory to Bobby Unser. He was instead fined $40,000.
He clearly, I think, would have won the race regardless, and it's too bad that, you know, he did what he did, because if he had not done it, he still could have won the race, and it wouldn't have been tainted. We didn't know that that was going to be it, because the next year he comes back and he's Joseli Garza's coach. But the plan was that if they got Joseli in with little or no difficulty, that Bobby was going to drive a second car for that team. And it ended up being such a struggle to get Joseli in that it was kind of a last-minute thing, so that ended that, although he did drive in practice. Then he sat out the year, basically, to be Joseli's coach. And then in 83, then he joined the Patrick team. And he was going to be John Cox's teammate. And then he had a situation in Phoenix where the bodywork came off in a test in March, I think it was. And then he decided at that point to retire. So it came about in a rather unusual way. And so it ended up that when he won the 500 in 81, that was his last run at the Speedway. But it took a couple of years before we realized that that was going to be the case.
The 1981 500 was one of the most controversial in history, sadly. It was also Unser's last. At the time of his victory, he was the oldest man to win the 500, and he now says that he had no plans to come back in 1982.
I had pretty much accomplished quite a bit in this life, and I was not going to go to work and miss my last son. I didn't quit racing. It's just that I wasn't going to pass up my youngest son. That was all successful. He ended up going to Indy, finished fifth and an eighth there. And, you know, more than Daddy's job was done.
Bobby Unser stopped driving Indy cars and became a commentator, with one of his proudest calls coming in 1987, when brother Al broke his record and became the oldest winner in Speedway history, joining the 4-time club.
And now here it is. Your brother, Al Unser, joins A.J. Foyt. Only two men ever to win the Indianapolis 500 four times in his life.
That is fabulous. That is absolutely fabulous. I just cannot believe it.
Bobby, congratulations. That is simply fantastic.
Thank you.
That's just great.
This has been a day. This makes up for Robbie getting his leg broken.
Unser became a popular voice on television, spending plenty of time and good-natured sparring with fellow former racer Sam Posey.
Those were good days, and I hope people don't think I dislike Sam. I know I picked on him a little bit, but by the same token, if he'd have said the right things, I wouldn't have picked on him so much.
Bobby Unser won 35 IndyCar races, 2 national driving championships, and was one of the finest sprint car drivers in history. He says winning against some of the best drivers of all time is one major feather in his cap.
People wouldn't realize it, but in those days, let's just take like a sprint car race, which we did so much of around that part of the world, that if you finished a third, fourth, or fifth, or sixth, man, you had done something good. Because look at the guys that probably were in front of you, you know, Foyt and McCluskey and Rutherford and Branson and just go on down to Judd Larson. I mean, there were so many of those guys that anywhere, if you could finish in the top 10, boy, you had really cracked a big nut that day, really done well. And, of course, I don't think these new guys will ever realize how hard and how good the competition used to be.
He won three Indianapolis 500s and can sum up his key to success with one word.
Desire, in my opinion, is the single biggest, most important thing that there is in the world. No matter what country, what language you speak, no matter whether you're rich, poor, doesn't make any difference. If you have desire, you're going to accomplish what other people just don't. The guy with the most desire will be the most successful.
We want to take a moment to thank the following people for their contributions to the history of the 500. Matt Hiblin, Scott Johnston, Kevin Lee, Mark Monteith, R.J. Crace, Mike Thompson, also Charlie Morgan, Bob Richards, and David Wood. Thanks to all of the voices who appeared in this series. Also, to Wally Levitt and IMS Productions. And a special thank you for joining us for the history of the 500. I'm Steve Simpson.